Welcome to Inclusion Unlocked, where we explore the changing equity, diversity, and inclusion landscape, bringing you fresh perspectives, lived experiences, practical tips, and next practice. I'm Sasha Scott, and I'm the founder and CEO of Inclusive Group. We're an equity, diversity, and inclusion consultancy in the business of behaviour. Alongside our guests, we'll be exploring challenging topics and focusing on action, considering the practical steps each of us can take, whether we're leaders, HR practitioners, or colleagues, to unlock inclusion in our workplace. So today, I'm joined by Chief Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Officer for Warner Brothers Discovery, Azif Sadiq. Azif is one of the most influential DEI leaders in the world, with a career spanning the City of London Police, EY, Adidas, and The Telegraph. We take a deep dive into challenges standing in the way of progress on diversity, from the rise in anti-woke sentiment to a focus on, as Azif beautifully puts it, random acts of diversity. We explore a host of practical ways that DEI practitioners, leaders, and organizations can make authentic change. And we also discuss how Azif's early career helped shape who he is today. So get a pen and paper ready, because this episode is packed with tips and insights that you will want to take a note of. Okay, hello everyone. Thanks so much for dialing into Inclusion Unlocked. And I'm absolutely delighted to have such an amazing guest with us today, Azif. Azif, thank you so much for giving us your time on this most boiling day ever. I really, really appreciate it. And it's been, I don't know, a couple of years since we sat together on a panel. And it's nice to reconnect with you, albeit through the screen and through the glass. Azif, I'm just going to jump straight into to my first question, because I for one, am really curious, and I know our listeners will be really curious to learn more about your early career. You have become, without a question of a doubt, one of the most prominent DEI leaders in the industry. And your career spanned working for the City of London Police, EY, The Telegraph, Adidas, and now, of course, Warner Brothers Discovery. But before we kind of go into that and the meat of what sure. the challenges are and how you're navigating those, can we take a step back and can you tell us a little bit about your early career and how insights from your early career have shaped what you do today?
Definitely, yeah. So as you mentioned, I started off my career in the City of London Police as a police officer, interestingly, so not as a civilian. And it's quite interesting when you think about why and how I ended up joining the police, because I studied a bachelor's in management and human resource management. But at the time, there was a lot of challenges. You know, this is going back, 20 odd years with the police service. I still remember, you know, as a student getting turned over by the police very often, you know, and it was usually the same thing. Have you got drugs? Have you got this? And I remember one day sort of reflecting on it and thinking to myself, this needs to change. But in order for it to change, I can't sit on the outside and expect it to change. I need to be part of that system in order to change it. And therefore I joined the police service and, you know, worked in numerous different departments, initially from uniform policing, CID, counterterrorism, economic crime, and then went on to head up the Equality, Diversity and Human Rights Department. And that was fascinating because I had the opportunity to be seconded to work with the UN and OSCE, and I ended up working in Bosnia, Rwanda, Israel, in the US as well. And it was fascinating. I say fascinating because I saw the real consequences of not addressing challenges when it comes to equality, equity, diversity. And you know, as you're probably aware, with a lot of these countries, when you think about like Bosnia and the genocide in Bosnia, that was a result of small elements of discrimination, biases, hatred, left, you know, unaddressed, to the point that escalated into this element of hate and for people started killing each other. And same with Rwanda, you know, same sort of situation. So that shaped a lot around, you know, when you've seen the absolute extremes of what humans can get up to, you almost have this sort of, everything else seems like it's, you can solve it. And once you've seen that, So that shaped a lot around just me wanting to do more, me really understanding that if you don't address this, whether it's, of course, in a country or in a business, that there are consequences.
Gosh, that's really, really fascinating to see it in such extremes. And it makes me think of today's environment, that we're seeing such a pace of change against liberalism and against inclusion and such polarization. Do you reflect a lot on
Completely.
those extremes when you're looking at today?
Completely, completely. And I think one of the biggest challenges we face today is we've gone in such opposite ends. And it's almost like I describe it as, almost like if two people are holding a rubber band but going in opposite ends. And you've got, people going to the far left and people going to the far right, and there's no middle left. And the problem with that is that rubber band's going to snap. And when it snaps, we're going to have challenges and issues. And we're already seeing a lot of it, right? Where people are, when you look at some of the legislation in the US that's being passed, when you look at some of the other legislation, even in the UK, you can see that's extremes where people have not been included or part of the conversation, or have felt that diversity somehow, eliminates them, or, they're not part of the conversation. So we're getting this, complete extremes. And I haven't seen this in such a long time. I didn't even reflect on this, but now that you mentioned it, it's going back 20 years, right? To that complete opposites, people not talking. We can't disagree or learn to disagree, but still, respect each other, talk to each other. So it is quite scary.
Yeah, I'm glad that you've said that, because this the metaphor of the elastic band. Having a huge tension, which I think is absolutely where we are now, and then snapping, the consequences are, what will happen to, our workplaces if society snaps? Because it's what's out there becomes
exactly.
within our organizations, right? I mean, you've been doing this a long time. It is fair to say that neither of us have seen anything like this from a kind of UK-centric perspective?
No, completely, completely. And I think, just to the point that you mentioned, we are in our workplaces a reflection of society. We do live in that society. So, we can't sit in our workplaces and assume what's happening in the world around us will not impact our workplace. It will. The more the conversations continue in the direction that they are, unfortunately, continuing, where it's us versus them, it will start happening in the workplace. And that's why it's so important more than ever before that we do create those platforms for dialogue. We do create environments where, we're not calling out, but we're calling in. So, we're allowing people to come in, we're having conversations, we're disagreeing, but disagreeing in a way that we're trying to educate and learn and grow together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the massive struggle around that is that requires a level of consciousness that is open to listen to different sort of points of view, doesn't it? It requires that growth mindset. And I really fear that there are so many people, groups of people that just are in an echo chamber through our data and through, the algorithms. It's very easy never to hear the other point of view and then to believe, right? So the biases that we have just grow and manifest unless we can get outside of the echo chamber. And that takes some consciousness.
Completely, completely. And also, I guess, a sense of feeling that if you do come up that out of that sort of echo chamber and engage, that there'll be dialogue, right? And there'll be conversation.
Yeah.
And I think that fear again of, if I come out of that and I have that conversation, no one's going to listen. No one's going to care what I think. That's probably what's resulting in people not then coming into that space of conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And then if we keep this at a kind of work environment, with work environment lens, what do our leaders do? How can leaders, and I'm going totally off script,
no,
here,
don't worry.
But how can leaders help create inclusion? What are those kind of behaviors? Because I'm sure you have over the years seen so many different manifestations of inclusive leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking in 2023, what is it that you expect your leaders to be able to lean into what are those behaviors, you know, in today's environment?
Yeah, and I guess the first big thing is, you know, when we think about leadership and actually preparing leaders for championing inclusion, it can't be the, you know, 2-hour workshop, half day unconscious bias training, because that doesn't change behaviors. What we really need to do is embed long-term sustainable change and equip the leaders to feel that they've got a set of tools that they can use to engage in this conversation. Now, interestingly, we've just launched our inclusive leadership journey. So for our top leaders, 200 odd leaders, they're going to go on a 12-month journey. And that 12 months will involve traditional classroom-based learning, experiential learning, group learning, coaching, group coaching, elective modules that they decide what they want. And the whole idea of that is that over a sustained period of time, with different ways of introducing the whole concept of diversity, equity, and inclusion, you're getting them to truly own it, become comfortable with it, and learn how they can champion it going forward. And I think that piece is hugely important. The second piece, in the absence, of course, of training, it's how do we create psychological safety, or get leaders to create psychological safety for themselves and others to really, truly, to have these conversations, right? To be able to champion it. And that requires an element of vulnerability, leaders to understand that, you know, you don't have to be right all the time, and it's okay not to have the answers. That's not a sign of weakness, but actually it's a stronger leader who really puts their hand up and says, I'm not really sure about this, or I'm not sure how to approach this. Can you help me? And I think that's where leaders need to be. No one's expecting them to be, you know, experts on them, and no one's an expert. You know, we're not. We've just got experiences and we can share them. But leaders need to understand that, because I think the fear of having conversations, fear of getting diversity wrong, saying the wrong thing, is preventing them from leaning in to actually have those conversations and to drive change.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I feel that that fear factor has increased dramatically in the last 12 months. And if we look at very, very typical leaders in corporates that we are engaging with, they tend to be straight white men predominantly. Mm-hmm. And that group of people, I call that person Eric. Hello, Eric. But Eric is increasingly saying, this isn't really my conversation. I'm terrified to get it wrong, and therefore there is a paralysis that means I'm avoiding it. So the opposite of leaning in, but more running away.
Completely.
So I love to hear what you're doing there over a 12-month period. It feels to me like a really deep education, which is both conceptual and visceral, and you're passionate. I would maybe choose modules of things I'm really interested in to learn more. Do you use reverse mentoring? What's your view on reverse mentoring? Because we're seeing a lot of intergenerational bias as well. And I wondered if you talk to me more around mentoring. And
sure. So, I mean, the reverse mentoring piece we're building into the inclusive leadership journey, so they have that opportunity as well. And again, what we wanted to do with it is for it not to feel as though it's a burden, another learning, another training. We're building it in a way that will be like, oh, another great thing or another different thing. So it's constantly keeping them interested with the ever-evolving different ways that we're going to deliver it. I mean, there's a module that's going to be actors that are going to deliver a situation in diversity.
Lovely.
So it's really going to hopefully capture them in a way that it really, you know, sort of buys them in. I think on the mentoring piece, you know, I've for long said that mentoring's great. You know, it's really positive. But sponsorship is where we really need to get to. You know, we know, and statistically research shows, women and those from underrepresented backgrounds are less likely to be sponsored. It comes naturally to straight white men, not asking them to apologize. You know, it happens for them, great. But they need to acknowledge there's others who don't have that same pathway. And how do we create those opportunities for others to be able to you know, have that sponsorship so someone's vouching for them when they're not in the room, someone's their voice when they're not there, someone's getting them onto the projects that are going to get them promoted. And that piece actually goes beyond, I mean, sponsorship's one element, but it's, you know, even in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space, many organizations have done great work in addressing all the formal processes, right? So, you know, we've got a policy around recruitment, we've done something around promotions and so on, and that's amazing work. The problem is, half the challenges in this space are the informal processes that exist. Now it's time to actually move from the formal to the informal, like sponsorship, which is an informal thing. You know, there's no official, you know, Eric sponsors someone, it just happens. But how do we create that for others? Or recruitment, you know, we talk about recruiting people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, diverse backgrounds. How are we tackle the official, you know, processes? What about the informal challenges? You know, maybe not having money to get onto a tube to come into London or a train to come into London, those kind of things. And I think that's where our efforts need to now shift, is the informal elements that we can start to address and create more equity in.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I was talking to someone quite recently who said that they'd got onto a scheme which was focused on social mobility. And they said, but the organization that had given them this place didn't realize that it was based in London, and this person had no friends in London, couldn't afford to pay for a hotel, had no contacts, and said, you know, Sasha, had it not been for some friends so far, I wouldn't have ever got that opportunity. And the sponsorship is really so critical. And I think people find it a little challenging, because I think that people get very focused on what is sponsorship, how do I do it? And how do I do it with someone who may be different from me? Exactly. I think it's super straightforward to sponsor and basically speak up for people who are in your in-group and who you have affinity with. It's much more problematic for people. And therefore, again, human nature is, ooh, God, that feels uncomfortable. I don't think I'll do that. Or maybe I just don't do it because I'm being uncomfortable. And I think it goes full circle back to your model around psychological safety and leaning in and being vulnerable and not necessarily feeling you've got this nailed, but do it anyway.
Completely. And also
just the small things.
Yeah, completely. And also actually the piece around within that, you know, sponsorship relationship or even a line manager relationship, right? How do you give constructive feedback? Because sponsorship, if you're going to meet someone who's different to you and just tell them, oh, you're great, you know, it's really nice meeting you, you've got a great future, they're never going to progress. Whereas again, when there's someone who's in the in-group or has similarities to you, you're more likely to go in and say, listen, you really need to, you know, make your presentation skills better. You really need to focus on this. And that's missed. So we need to get leaders more comfortable in giving constructive feedback, because one of the biggest challenges when it comes to people from underrepresented backgrounds progressing is that all year round they're told how great they are, and no one gives them feedback. And then it comes to the promotion and they're told, well, you're not ready yet. And you're like, well, what happened to actually telling me over the last 12 months what I'm not ready or what areas I need to focus on so I could build them? And that again goes back to the psychological safety, the fear of getting it wrong, saying the wrong thing, being labeled sexist, racist, homophobic, you know, whatever element. But we must, you know, feedback and constructive feedback, of course, feedback without bias, that's important, but giving feedback is fine. I mean, if if I was line managing someone who's different to me and I need to give them some honest feedback, I will do, because it's for their growth, it's for their development. There shouldn't be fear around giving that.
Yeah, I think the fear is, this person is ticking a diversity box.
Exactly.
I'm terrified to do it, therefore I won't. And of course, you and I know, and many people listening in from an HR or whatever background, is that then we're actually setting ourselves up for a massive potential sort of claim or issues, and we lose people because people are scared to have conversations around performance because it feels difficult.
Exactly.
Yeah. So part of developing our future leaders is really getting them to get comfortable with being uncomfortable and to back it up with the objective data of why X, Y, and Z isn't doing their job well enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and actually it's interesting you mentioned actors. We've seen a really big increase over the last probably 18 months of clients wanting to work in much more visceral ways. So using film, using actors, using scenarios to shift that heart. Mm-hmm. And also using actors to get it wrong, because that's kind of safe,
exactly.
Right? And I think I'm delighted that that's back in the room more and we're seeing that. I want to ask you something, just slightly moving away, but in the same space. I've noticed, as a DEI practitioner and looking after a lot of people now that work with Inclusive Group, that we're often on the receiving end of some hostility. And I've not ever noticed that directly over the last 20 odd years of doing this. I'm wondering... your views on you know, that hostility that we're touching on anyway, but also in how we protect people. How do you insulate your people and indeed yourself from hostility in today's world?
Yeah, no, I think it's tough, right? I think the first big thing, especially in the D&I space, I learned very early on to detach my emotions from the work I do, because otherwise, I can't take my work with me constantly, not sleep because someone said something and so on. So I detach myself personally from my work.
Okay.
Because and also because the challenge is if I'm attached to it from a personal perspective, that doesn't mean I'm not, you know, vested in it. I am. But if I attach from a personal perspective, when something doesn't go my way, when a project is refused because, you know, for whatever so reason, then it's personal. But if I'm not personally attached to it, then it's a business, right? It's a business project, and I can go away, redesign it, bring it back. I think the hostility piece is interesting. And I think it sort of goes back to that first point around, there was people last couple of years who, you know, when we had the murder of George Floyd, when there was a lot of engagement in the D&I space, there was people who, you know, there was people who were very keen, very engaged, wanted to do a lot. There was others who probably weren't so keen, but didn't say anything because they were too scared, you know, didn't want to get it, you know, wrong, didn't want to get, you know, labeled racist or anything else. I think now, because as you're seeing in the world around us, people are challenging things. Everyone feels now that, well, actually, I can push back on this. I think the other element in some defense of some of these people is with the, you know, the global sort of crisis financially, whether it's, you know, actually going to happen, not happening. Many companies are in that sort of system of, you know, either trying to restructure or, you know, looking at losses. And at that point, unfortunately, because we still had so much work to do to bring the link around diversity is critical to business, and it's necessary for business success, some individuals, I feel their thought process is that, well, now, you know, we're going through all this, we need so much to do in the company, we haven't got time for this stuff. This stuff's not, yeah. And I'm like, actually, now is when you need this stuff more than ever before. So I think, yeah, it's a bit of both currently.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I see the same in terms of more negative sentiment towards things like ESG and the climate, again, reflective of the polarization of the world, which makes me feel that the work we do is even more important than it ever has been. And I find it very thought-provoking and really actually really good advice around that piece of detachment slightly, because otherwise it's so easy to get so sucked in and then we lose our objective head on this. So I feel a duty of care. Definitely. And a protection to insulate people, but also we've got to work on our own sort of resilience and Definitely. How we manage that. I know for some organisations that there is a frustration that despite a really long-standing commitment to DEI, the pace of change is just not quick enough. And I wonder, it's a big question, but what your top tips are to ensure that a diversity strategy affects meaningful changes, because so many organizations are at such embryonic stages, and you're in such developed organizations, have had such interesting experiences. What kind of tips would you give organizations that are much earlier on or are super impatient, like we're not seeing the data that says that we're doing a good job?
I think it's a reflection on what have they done. A lot of organizations have focused on some of the textbook stuff, or the, you know, what I call sort of, or, you know, the diversity actions, the random acts of diversity is how I label them. You know, they've done a lot of that. This action, that random this, that random that.
Yeah.
The problem is that those random acts of diversity were not going to drive change ever. They were just feel good moments at a period or during a period of time. Feel good moments don't last because they've not actually changed any systems or systematic long-term change. For long-term systematic change, we must create the environments that, you know, then drive that D&I, really embed it, really sort of make it part and parcel of what an organization's core and foundations are. That's the important thing. And some of that means that we must reset. So we recently launched our diversity strategy. And, you know, everyone was waiting for this great innovation. And it is innovative in some respects, but some of it is foundational stuff. because I'm like, we need the basics in place before, you know, because what we many organizations did do is they started running, but they hadn't learned to walk yet. And then they were tripping up over themselves and, you know, every small hurdle didn't know what to do. So I'm like, let's go back. Let's learn to walk properly and then we'll run. There's all the time in the world to run if we know how to walk first. You know, even something like we've just launched a couple of weeks back, our global diversity data collection exercise. One of the first organizations to globally collect data.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's been a huge project because there's, of course, legal challenges in certain countries. There's cultural nuances. But what we did was we didn't let that stop us. We continued to work on it. Okay, so in this country, we can't ask anything around sexual orientation. That's fine. We'll ask the other questions. We won't ask that. Or in this country, we can ask around sexual orientation, but culturally, it's not accepted. So we'll ask the question in a different way. So we try to solve rather than the, it's too difficult, we're not going to do it. Now, collecting data is not groundbreaking. However, having that data will give us the systems, the processes and understanding of where we need to put our efforts, where the real challenges lie and where we need to double down our work. And so I guess that's the big advice, not to do the actions. I mean, the actions are great. They, as I said, they feel good moments, right? The we launched this or we did this. And there's a need for that. You know, everyone needs a feel good moment every so often where we feel like we've done something. But in the background, it's that systematic long-term change and the foundations of that we're creating that's going to truly drive the strategy.
That's incredibly good advice. And steering you back to the data, you know, is something that you know, people are quite understandably nervous about, particularly with a global lens. How it sounds to me that you've taken a really kind of solutions orientated approach where it is nuanced and reflective of the global sort of needs or requirements in those countries. How long did that project take to build it and then to implement it?
Wow. So it's probably taken about 2 years. And I say 2 years, not because the project in itself required that long. It's just learnings along the way, right? And this is the thing. The other, you know, in diversity, we sometimes, or the work in inclusion and equity, we wait for the right moment. There isn't a right moment. We just need to start, learn, try again, start, learn, try again. And we learned a lot of things. Like, you know, I still remember, you know, when we initially designed it, we're capturing data on, you know, as different strands, gender, race and ethnicity, sexual orientation, disability and religion, where you can. And I remember designing it. And then someone was like, well, OK, for race in this country, what categories are we going to use? I was like, wow, that's a really good question. Then we went to look at census data. So each country, we've looked at what their, you know, racial or ethnic groups are based on census data. We captured that. We legal, internal legal checked it, external legal checked it. Because, again, confidence, right? Like, our legal teams are great, but having that surety that someone externally has checked it, who's going to have access to it? You know, GDPR in Europe and so on. So there's a lot of things. And, you know, if I was to do it again today, it wouldn't take that long because we've learned the lessons. Mm-hmm. We know what to do. And we're still learning. Even with the exercise going live, there's things we're learning. There's things that we continue to grow. And we've got, you know, we've got, this is phase one. We've got phase two, phase three. Thing is, we didn't wait for that perfect moment. We said, you know, as long as we've legally covered everything, we're reasonably comfortable that we've understood cultural nuances, legal requirements, we launched. And now we'll look at it again. If we miss something, we'll go back.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And out of curiosity, when that lands and you say to your people, please, would you offer this data? Yeah, what kind of sentiment are you getting back? How do you manage the expectations about why do you want my data and what's it for? Because that internal dialogue is really critical for people getting or not getting the whole EDI thing, I think.
So one of the things we've tried to do is, I mean, our campaign's called Be Counted. And the whole idea behind it is it's about everyone, right? And we want every single person to provide their data. What we've tried to do is give people an understanding of, number one, how we will use the data. So examples of that data will be used in this way to drive change, you know, how we can use it from an equity perspective and so on. To then give them sureties around things that they might feel. So will everyone be able to access my data? Can people identify me and so on? So we've tried to address every single thing. And we've also tried to say, because again, from experience of doing data more locally in other companies, the other big challenge is the majority in a company The straight white men of a certain age group, sometimes they don't provide the data because they think it's going to be used against them. And what we've said is, even if you don't want to give us or share your data with us, whatever group you are, go online and tick their prefer not to say. Because I want to know, if you prefer not to say, then I know we've got a challenge with people's confidence around the data. But not filling it out makes me feel like maybe you didn't hear about it. Maybe you didn't know about it. So we've tried to do that. We've tried to get leaders equipped because leaders make a huge difference, where, you know, leaders should know exactly what it is so that if a staff member comes up to them and says, hey, what's this, you know, data collection exercise, they can explain what it is and what it means.
Yeah, brilliant. Again, it's about knowledge, information. And I think when people know why it's being used, they're far more likely to share.
Exactly.
So really helpful, the reset, the foundational, the data piece, really, really helpful advice. Of course, the clock's always against us. And I want to talk about something external because the reach of Warner Brothers is obviously absolutely phenomenal as a platform. And I know that your focus isn't just on driving EDI within the organization, but, and this really fascinates me, considering representation and inclusion in film, in programming, in media. What approach do you take to that? The whole representation piece. Really love to hear about that.
And it is fascinating because my role is not a traditional internal D&I role only. So I look after the internal, but external diversity, equity and inclusion on our productions, the creative side and so on. Our approach is, there's a few different things. I mean, the first big thing for me is we must tell authentic stories. And what I mean by that is that we must move away from stereotypes. You know, how do we tell stories that are truly representative of communities? You know, you don't want every time we have someone who's of a certain someone who looks like me, every time they're on screen, they're a terrorist, because that's a stereotype you're building in. It's not an authentic representation. Or every time you have someone black, they're in, you know, a particular role and so on. So that's the first piece around authentic representation. Or even on, you know, as you probably know, we have, you know, from Cartoon Network, HBO, CNN, a whole sort of, you know, spectrum of things. And then it's building in the authentic representation in a way that it also resonates with the audiences in the same way. So if someone picks it up, they're like, oh, that's an authentic representation of me, not a stereotype. Maybe I'll give you an example. There was a show recently, not one of ours, that was trending on TikTok. And it was basically a firefighting show. And there was a female who wore a headscarf. She was a firefighter. And in the, you know, as she was fighting a fire, a headscarf came off. And these 6-7 men came around her, covered her, you know, saved her. And I was reading the comments. Every single comment was, thank you for the representation, but no thank you. We don't all need to be saved. We don't need, you know, stop building these same stereotypes, because then they play out in society, right? The perception is, you know, a Muslim female wearing a headscarf needs to be saved, the poor woman. That's not true. Yeah. There's some very strong women. It's that sort of authentic representation piece. How do we do it? Now, we run a number of pipeline programs. What we've discovered is that our industry is more difficult for underrepresented groups to access. So we run pipeline programs, which are really development programs for writers, directors, on-screen talent, off-screen talent, like the whole sort of piece, where we take underrepresented groups, give them the training they need, and then an opportunity to work on one of our shows. In the UK, we're running Black Britain Unspoken, which is about getting Black filmmakers to make shorts that we will support them with, you know, from a financial perspective, but also with the sort of mentoring they need to get it to the point that it needs to be. And then we'll air it on Discovery Plus and give them a platform. So it's that kind of thing that we're trying to really, truly invest in. So to drive change, build the pipeline into the industry that's more diverse, tell authentic stories, and also representation beyond your traditional diversity element. So when you look at some of our most recent shows, The Last of Us, right?
Yeah.
When you look at the lead actor, he's not playing a stereotypical role that he would play based on his ethnicity or where he comes from. He's playing a mainstream role. And that's a change as well, right? It's getting people into, so we're not sort of pigeonholed into certain roles or only doing certain things. And it's fascinating because everyone's like, well, that must be quite complex. It's exactly what we do internally, but it's making sure it's built into our business proposition. And why is it important for us? Because that's the other, you know, $1 million, £1 million question. It's important because our consumers are diverse. We're a global company. We reach, you know, numerous different parts of the world. And we want people to see a representation of themselves. We want people to see authentic stories that they can reflect on. And, you know, there's a lot of positive work happening, and people criticize a lot of things. There's a show currently that's being criticized for having, you might have seen it, the mermaid that's black.
Yes.
And, you know, yes. I'm like, firstly, the whole sort of piece around mermaids are fictional characters. So the fact that it's black, white, like, it shouldn't make a difference. Why are people so upset with a fictional character being black? Yeah. It's a positive thing. So, but I'm so proud that they did that, even though it's a competitor, like they've, you know, another media company. That is great. They're challenging the norms, changing the systems, the processes that, you know, really truly create representation.
Absolutely. And the media has been such a strong vehicle in so many ways, very supportive of diversity and being able to sort of completely, you know, explode stereotypes. And we've seen some amazing shows in the last 5 years that really resonate. As a gay woman, just the representation of lesbians has just increased dramatically away from the kind of standard stereotypical, you know, image that we used to have. Again, very generationally driven, but it's such a powerful mechanism, a vehicle for change. And it, you know, brings us full circle round to the beginning of our conversation, which is, at the end of the day, you know, the world is fractured and polarized, and there are ways that we can connect people. And I think that what you do, both internally and externally, and your team and the people, you know, at Warner Brothers with yourself, can really, really move hearts and minds in an incredibly powerful way.
Definitely.
So, yeah, thank you for such an interesting conversation. I really, really appreciate your time. You're such a formidable and impressive human being. You. So I really thank you for coming to talk to us on Inclusion Unlocked, as if thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
I could have spoken with Azeev for hours. What a huge privilege to hear such wide-ranging and valuable insights. Making meaningful and lasting change when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion is not without its challenges. If you'd like to hear more about how we can help you in your organization drive real change, I'd love to hear from you. To find out more about our work at Inclusive Group or arrange a conversation, please click on the link on the landing page of this episode and follow it through to our website. We look forward to hearing from you.